Chapter 15. It was 11 o'clock in the evening, Philippines time, when Pitt and Giordino stepped off a commercial flight from Seattle, passed through customs, and entered the main terminal lobby of the Ninoy Aquino International Airport. Off to the side of a milling crowd, they found a man holding a crudely lettered cardboard sign. Placards in the hands of greeters usually advertised the names of arriving passengers. This one simply said, Smith. He was a great slob of a man. He might have been an Olympic weightlifter at one time, but his body had gone to seed, and his stomach had grown into an immense watermelon. It sagged and hung over a pair of soiled pants and an overstressed leather belt 3 sizes too small. The face appeared scarred from dozens of fights, and his great hooked nose had been broken so often it veered to one side across the left cheek. Stubble covered the lips and chin. It was difficult to tell whether his eyes looked bloodshot from too much booze or too little sleep. The black hair was plastered over his head like some kind of greasy skull cap, and the teeth were irregular and yellow. His biceps and forearms seemed remarkably taut and muscled in comparison with the rest of him, and were laden with tattoos. He wore a grimy yachtsman's cap and dingy coveralls.
"Shiver me timbers," muttered Giordino, "if it isn't old Blackbeard hisself."
Pitt walked up to the mangy derelict and said,
"Good of you to meet us, Mr. Smith."
"Happy to have you aboard,"
Smith said with a cheerful smile. "The captain's expecting you."
Carrying only a few articles of underwear, toiletries, and work shirts and pants picked up at a surplus store on the way to the Seattle airport, and all stuffed in a pair of small carry-on tote bags, Pitt and Giordino had no reason to wait at the baggage carousel. They fell in behind Smith and walked out of the terminal into the airport parking lot. Smith stopped at a Toyota van that looked as if it spent its life in endurance runs around the Himalayan mountains. Half the windows were broken out and taped closed with plywood boards. The body paint was faded to the primer, and the rocker panels were rusted away. Pitt observed the deeply treaded off-road tires and listened with interest to the throaty roar of a powerful engine as it immediately kicked to life when Smith pressed the starter. The van moved off with Pitt and Giordino sitting on the torn and worn vinyl upholstery. Pitt lightly prodded his friend with his elbow to get his attention and spoke loud enough for the driver to hear.
"Tell me, Mr. Giordino, is it true you're a very observant person?"
"That I am," Giordino came back, picking up Pitt's intent instantly. "Nothing escapes me. And let us not forget you, Mr. Pitt. Your powers of prognostication are also world-renowned. Would you like to demonstrate your talents?"
"I would indeed."
"Let me begin by asking, what do you make of this vehicle?"
"I have to say it looks like a prop out of a Hollywood movie that no self-respecting hippie would be caught dead in. And yet it sports expensive tires and an engine that puts out around 400 horsepower. Most peculiar, wouldn't you say?"
"Very astute, Mr. Pitt. My vision exactly."
"And you, Mr. Giordino, what does your remarkable insight see in our bon vivant driver?"
"A man obsessed with chicanery, skullduggery, and connivory. In short, a rip-off artist."
Giordino was in his element and on the verge of getting carried away.
"Have you noticed his bulging stomach?"
"A poorly positioned pillow."
"Exactly," Giordino exclaimed as if it were a revelation. "Then there are the scars on the face and the flattened nose."
"Poorly applied makeup?" Pitt asked innocently.
"There's no fooling you, is there?"
The driver's ugly face twisted in a scowl through the rearview mirror, but there was no stopping Giordino.
"Of course you caught the hairpiece floating in pomade."
"I most certainly did."
"How do you read his tattoos?"
"Inscribed by pen and ink," offered Pitt.
Giordino shook his head.
"I'm disappointed in you, Mr. Pitt. Stencils.
Any apprentice remote viewer would envision them being stenciled on the skin.
I stand rebuked. Unable to remain quiet, the driver snapped over his shoulder.
You two pretty boys think you're smart.
We do what we can, said Pitt lightly.
Having done their dirty work and advertised the fact that they had not fallen off a pumpkin wagon, Pitt and Giordino remained silent as the van drove onto a pier of a shipping terminal. Smith dodged around huge overhead cranes and stacked freight, finally stopping opposite an opening in a railing along the pier's edge. Without a word of instruction, he stepped from the vehicle and walked toward a ramp leading to a launch that was tied to a small floating dock. The two Numa men obediently followed and climbed into the launch. The sailor standing at the helm in the stern of the boat was a consort in black. Black pants, black t-shirt, and black stocking cap pulled down over the ears despite the tropical heat and humidity. The launch eased away from the wooden pilings and turned her bow toward a ship that lay anchored about two-thirds of a mile from the terminal. Around her were the lights from other ships waiting for their turn to load or unload cargo under the great cranes. The atmosphere was as clear as cut glass, and far across Manila Bay the colored lights of fishing boats sparkled like gemstones against the black sky. The shape of the ship began to rise in the night, and Pitt could see that she was not the typical tramp steamer that plowed the South Seas from island to island. He correctly identified her as a Pacific Coast lumber hauler, with clean, unencumbered holds and no amidship superstructure. Her engine room was in the stern below the crew's quarters. A single stack rose just aft of the wheelhouse and behind it, a tall mast. A second, smaller mast rose from the forecastle on the bow. Pitt guessed her at somewhere between 4 and 5,000 tons, with a length of just under 300 feet and a 45-foot beam. A vessel her size could have carried nearly 3 million board feet of lumber. Her time had long come and gone. Her sister ships, which had carried the product of sawmills, had settled into the silt of the boneyard almost 50 years earlier, having been replaced by more modern towboats and barges.
"What's her name?" Pitt asked Smith.
"The Oregon."
"I imagine she carried a goodly amount of lumber in her day."
Smith looked at Pitt across the launch, inspecting him closely.
"How could a pretty boy like you know that?"
"When my father was a young man, he crewed on a lumber ship. He made 10 runs between San Diego and Portland before finishing college. He has a picture of the ship on his office wall."
"The Oregon sailed from Vancouver to San Francisco for close to 25 years before she was retired."
"I wonder when she was built."
"Long before you or I were born," said Smith.
The helmsman swung the launch alongside the hull, once painted a dark orange but now discolored by rust, as revealed by the running lights on the masts and the glow from the starboard navigation light. There was no gangway, only a rope boarding ladder with wood rungs.
"After you, pretty boy," said Smith, gesturing topside.
Pitt went first, trailed by Giordino. On the way up, Pitt wiped his fingers across a large scale of rust. The patch felt smooth, and no smudge dirtied his fingertips. The hatches on the deck were closed, and the cargo booms sloppily stowed. Several large wooden crates stacked on the deck looked like they had been secured by untrained chimpanzees. To all appearances, the crew ran what was often called a loose ship. None of them were seen, and the decks seemed deserted. The only indication of life was a radio playing a Strauss waltz. The music was inconsistent with the ship's overall appearance. Pitt thought an ode to a trash dump would have been more appropriate. He saw no sign of the Sea Dog II.
"Did our submersible arrive?" Pitt asked Smith.
"She's stowed in that large crate just behind the forecastle."
"Which way to the captain's cabin?"
The mangy escort lifted a plate in the deck that revealed a ladder leading into what seemed a cargo compartment.
You'll find him down there.
Ship captains aren't generally quartered in concealed compartments. Pitt looked up at the superstructure on the stern. On any ship I've known, the captain's cabin is below the wheelhouse.
Down there, pretty boy, Smith repeated.
What in hell has Sandecker gotten us into? Murmured Giardino suspiciously, as he turned his back to Pitts and instinctively went into a fighting crouch. Calmly, as if it was the most natural thing in the world, Pitt laid his tote bag on the deck, unzipped a pocket, and retrieved his old .45 Colt. Before Smith knew what was happening, the muzzle was jammed under his chin. Forgive me for not mentioning it, but I blew the head off the last jerk who called me Pretty Boy.
Okay, pal, Smith said without a hint of fear. I recognize a gun when I see one. Not one in mint condition, but obviously well used. Please point it somewhere else. You wouldn't want to get hurt now, would you?
I don't think it's me who's going to get hurt, Pitt said conversationally.
You might be wise to look around you.
It was the oldest trick in the book, but Pitt had nothing to lose. He glanced around the deck as men stepped out of the shadows. Not two men, not four, but six men every bit as disreputable as Smith, each holding automatic weapons pointed at Pitt and Giardino. Big, silent men dressed as mangily as Smith. Pitt pulled back the hammer and pressed the Colt another quarter inch into the flesh under Smith's chin.
Would it matter if I said, if I go, you go with me?
And allow your friend to be killed too, said Smith, with an ungodly grin. From what little I know about you, Pitt, you're not that dumb.
Just what do you know about me?
Put the gun away, and we'll talk.
I can hear you perfectly well from where I stand.
Relax, boys, said Smith to his men. We must show a little class and treat our guests with respect. Incredibly, the crew of the Oregon lowered their guns and began laughing.
Serves you right, Skipper, one of them said. You said they were probably a couple nerds from Numa who drank milk and ate broccoli.
Giardino smoothly joined the act.
You guys got any beer on this tub?
10 different brands, said a crewman, slapping him on the back. Glad to have passengers with a little guts on board. Pitt lowered the gun and eased the hammer back in the safety position.
I get the feeling we've been had.
Sorry to inconvenience you, said Smith heartily, but we can't let our guard down for even a moment. He turned to his men and issued an order. Weigh anchor, boys, and get underway for Hong Kong.
Admiral Sandecker said this was a singularly uncommon ship, said Pitt, replacing the automatic in his tote bag. But he didn't say anything about the crew.
If we can dispense with the theatrics, said Smith, I'll show you below. He dropped down the ladder through the narrow hatch and disappeared. Pitt and Giardino followed, finding themselves in a brightly lit, carpeted hallway whose walls were painted in pastel colors. Smith opened a smoothly varnished door and nodded inside.
You can share this cabin. Stow your gear, get comfortable, use the head, and then I'll introduce you to the captain. You'll find his cabin behind the fourth door on the port side aft.
Pitt stepped inside and switched on the light. This was no Spartan cabin on a decrepit freighter. It was every bit as swank as any stateroom on a luxury cruise ship. Ornately decorated and elegantly furnished, all that was missing were sliding doors leading to a private veranda. The only suggestion of the outside world was a porthole painted black.
What? Exclaimed Giardino. No bowl of fruit?
Pitt stared around the cabin in fascination.
I wonder if we have to dress formal when we dine with the captain.
They heard the anchor chain rattle up out of the water and felt the engines begin to throb through the deck under their feet as the Oregon began beating her way across Manila Bay toward her destination in Hong Kong. A few minutes later, they knocked on the door to the captain's cabin. A voice on the other side responded,
"Please come in."
If their cabin resembled a deluxe stateroom, this one would have easily rated as the penthouse suite. It resembled a decorator's showroom on Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills. The furniture was expensive, yet tasteful. The walls, or bulkheads in nautical terms, were either richly paneled or covered by curtains. The carpet was thick and plush. Two of the paneled walls were covered by original oil paintings. Pitt walked up to one and studied it. The painting, inside an ornate frame, was a seascape depicting a black man lying on the deck of a small, demasted sloop with a school of sharks swimming around its hull.
"Winslow Homer's Gulf Stream," said Pitt. "I thought it was hanging in a New York museum."
"The original is," said a man standing beside a large antique roll-top desk. "What you see are forgeries. In my line of business, no insurance company would insure the real thing." A handsome man in his mid-40s with blue eyes and blonde hair in a crew cut stepped forward and stuck out a manicured hand.
"Chairman Juan Rodriguez Cabrillo, at your service."
"Chairman, like in chairman of the board?"
"A departure from maritime tradition," Cabrillo explained. "This ship is run like a business, a corporation, if you will. The personnel prefer to be assigned corporate titles."
"That's a twist," Giordino said equably. "Don't tell me. I'm keen to guess. Your first officer is president."
Cabrillo shook his head.
"No, my chief engineer is president.
My first officer is executive vice president."
Giordino lifted an eyebrow.
"This is the first I've heard the Kingdom of Oz owns a ship."
"You'll get used to it," Cabrillo said tolerantly.
"If I recall my California history," said Pitt, "you discovered California in the early 1500s.
Cabrillo laughed.
"My father always claimed Cabrillo the Explorer as an ancestor, but I've had my doubts. My grandparents walked across the border at Nogales from Sonora, Mexico, in 1931, and became American citizens 5 years later. In honor of my birth, they insisted my mother and father name me after a famous historical figure in California."
"I believe we've met before," said Pitt.
"Like about 20 minutes ago," added Giordino.
"Your imitation of a waterfront derelict, Chairman Cabrillo, alias Mr. Smith, was very professional."
Cabrillo laughed merrily.
"You gentlemen are the first to see through my disguise as a rum-soaked barnacle." Unlike his staged character, Cabrillo was well-built and slightly on the thin side. The hook nose was gone, along with the tattoos and the overstuffed belly.
"I must admit you had me fooled until I saw the van."
"Yes, our shore transportation is not quite what it appears."
"This ship," said Pitt, "your play-acting, the facade, what's it all about?"
Cabrillo gestured for them to sit in a leather sofa. He walked over to a teak bar.
"A glass of wine?"
"Yes, thank you."
"I'd prefer a beer," said Giordino.
Cabrillo poured and held out a mug to Giordino.
"A Philippine San Miguel."
Then a wine glass to Pitt.
"Wattle Creek Chardonnay from Alexander Valley, California."
"You have excellent taste," Pitt complimented Cabrillo. "I have the feeling it extends to your kitchen."
Cabrillo smiled.
"I pirated my chef from a very exclusive restaurant in Brussels, Belgium. I might also add that should you get heartburn or indigestion from overindulging, we have an excellent hospital staffed by a top surgeon who doubles as a dentist. I'm curious, Mr. Cabrillo, what sort of trade is the Oregon engaged in, and who exactly do you work for?"
"This ship is a state-of-the-art intelligence-gathering vessel," Cabrillo replied without hesitation. "We go where no U.S. Navy warship can go. Enter ports closed to most commercial shipping,
and transport highly secret cargo without arousing suspicion. We work for any United States government agency that requires our unique array of services.
Then you're not under the CIA.
Cabrillo shook his head. Although we're staffed by a few ex-intelligence agents, the Oregon is operated by an elite crew of former naval men and naval officers, all of whom are retired.
I couldn't tell in the dark. What flag do you fly?
Iran, replied Cabrillo with a faint smile. The last country any port authority would identify with the United States.
Am I correct in assuming, said Pitt, you're all mercenaries?
I can honestly say we're in business to make a profit, yes. By performing a variety of clandestine services for our country, we are paid extremely well.
Who owns the ship? Asked Giordino.
Everyone on board is a stockholder in the corporation, answered Cabrillo. Some of us own more stock than others, but there isn't a single crew member who hasn't at least $5 million stashed away in foreign investments.
Does the IRS know about you?
The government has a secret fund for operations like ours, Cabrillo explained. We have an arrangement whereby they pay our fees through a network of banks in countries that do not open their records to IRS auditors.
Pitt took a sip of his wine. A sweet setup.
But one that isn't unknown to peril and occasional disaster. The Oregon is our third ship. The others were destroyed by unfriendly forces. I might add that over 13 years we've been in operation. We've lost no fewer than 20 men.
Foreign agents caught on to you?
No, we've yet to be unmasked. There were other circumstances. Whatever they were, Cabrillo didn't explain them.
Who authorized this trip? Inquired Giordino.
Between you and me and the nearest porthole, our sailing orders came from within the White House.
That's about as high as you can go.
Pitt looked at the captain. Do you think you can put us reasonably close to the United States? We have a couple of acres of hull to inspect, and our time underwater is limited due to the Sea Dog 2's battery power. If you have to moor the Oregon a mile or more away, just getting to the liner and back will cut our downtime considerably. Cabrillo stared back at him confidently.
I'll put you near enough to fly a kite over her funnels.
Then he poured himself another glass of the Chardonnay and held it up.
To a very successful voyage.